March 31st, 1980, talking to Al Wright in his home in Kona.
No, it's
okay.
Free to ramble.
Yeah, right. Right. You don't have to.
Yeah, well, I was born in Tanana Crossing in April 26, 1925, and my dad and mother were missionaries there at the time I was born, and I lived there for till I was just 1 year old, and then we moved from there to Nenana.
Have they told you what it was like there at the time you were born?
Yeah.
What kind of descriptions have you
heard? Well, it was a little Indian village on the Tanana River, Tupper Tanana. And at that time there was no, you know, roads or anything in there. The only way you get there was by boat out of Fairbanks. And at that time they had a old steamboat, a little small one with a stern wheeler on it, and it burned wood. And they said the way they got up there was they'd take off from Big Delta. There was a road to Big Delta then. And they'd head up the river, and all the crew and passenger whoever was on the boat, when they'd run out of fuel, they'd land along the bank and cut enough wood to go another day or two, and then they'd take off again up the river. They'd get into the places like Cathedral Bluffs or where the river was swift, and the boat didn't have enough poop to push it, so everybody'd have to get out and line the boat, pull on it, and run the engine until they get by it. Yeah, everybody was able. And until they get up above it. I think that trip took about 2 weeks from Big Delta to Tanana Crossing, which now they drive in 2 or 3 hours, you know, since they got the road in. But
do you know about how many people?
I think there was probably, in that village, there was only about 40 or 50 people living in there. But there was several other villages close around, like Tetlin and Mansfield Village, and a couple other villages. But this Tanana Crossing was the central point where they did their trading and came in. You know, it was a kind of a central location. It was on the Tanana River, and then they came into the river and fished in the summer there some. And that's probably why they, I don't know if there was a village. Yeah, there was. I think there was a village there before they started this mission. I think it started out as a trading post, though. I don't think there was a real village there before then. And then I can remember my dad telling stories about, you know, going to all these other villages to, you know, have weddings and church services and stuff. But he went by dog team to these different places. And actually the way he got going in it was, he was born in Tanana. And when he was real small, the church took him over and raised him and trained him. And then he became a missionary. And my mother came up there as a missionary nurse. And so when they got married, that was the first station they sent him to, because they were just opening up a new one there at Tanana Crossing. That's how they got there first. Well, from there, they moved to Nenana. And we lived there for, I think, about 4 years. And then they moved him to Minto. And actually, the way I got involved, why I'm a member of the Minto operation, is That's where my grandmother came from. My dad's mother was lived around there. And we lived there in Minto and for about 3 years. And then moved back to Nenana. And I went to finish going through school in Nenana. And
maybe we can talk a little bit about your parents and your grandparents, like their names and some of the things you remember about them.
Well, the only grandparent I knew was my grandmother, and she was actually pretty old when I knew her. She lived in Minto at that time. And of course I was real small. I was only about 5 when I knew her, and she died when I was about 7, I think. And so, I really didn't know her very well. But her name was Annie Glass. And I don't know what her name was before that, but I really don't know too much, about her. Or my grandfather, he came up here in the gold rush, I guess. And that's how, but I never did. He moved out, when my dad was just a little kid, moved out of the country, and I don't really know too much about him. Mm-hmm. I've heard a few stories, but. Well, I don't know. I heard that he was, when he came up, there's one story was when he came to Alaska, the gold rush, he was in partners with some guy in a bar down in Montana, and he wanted to come up here, so he just tapped the cash register and came up, and then when he went back, he went in to say hello, and his partner pulled a gun out from under the counter and shot him. That was one story. But there's a book called Sourdough Saga, and there's a little bit of stuff in about him in that.
What was somebody,
his name was Henry Wright. And but I really, just heard a few stories here and there about him, and nobody seems to know for sure whether they're true or not. My dad never talked about him hardly at all. He didn't even know him, I guess, because he was so small when he left. And when the church took him over and raised him, when he came back, he went to work hauling Bishop Rowe around the country. And some of these other missionaries, early time missionaries, he'd run the dogs for them and take them all over the country. And then the summer he'd take them around the country by boat up and down the river until he met my mother and they got married, and then they became the missionary.
He raised at Holy Cross Mission?
No, they sent him outside to, I think he went to school partly in Tanana, but I'm not really sure where he went. But I know he went to Mount Hermon School in Massachusetts for a while.
Oh, so he was with the Episcopal Church.
Yeah, he was with the Episcopal Church. And I'm not too sure how he probably told us at one time or another, but I can't remember where he was saved. But he had a pretty good education. And a lot more than I had, that's for sure.
What is your father's name and your mother's name?
His name was Arthur Wright, and my mother was Myrtle Wright. And And then, of course, she was, was in practice or nursing business in these villages that she was in. And probably one of the first ones that was ever in those, most of those villages. So she was a doctor and the whole works to everybody, you know. But,
I guess she's in some of these villages when they're having a lot of diseases.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and then when they had the big flu epidemic, she was in Ninan, I guess. But that's when, a lot of the people died off. Because it was, they weren't immune to this flu-type bug that came along. And it really got to the natives bad. A lot of them died. Of course, a lot of other people did, too. But, they had, a lot of big problems. Just small diseases were bad in those days, even like measles. These kids had, people had died from measles because they weren't, they had no immunity to it like the white people had, But anyway, she took care of all these, as many as she could, and anybody that had a problem. But,
so, were there any stories that either your mother or father told you about some of their experiences as missionaries? So even before you might remember the things they might have told you. So either about kind of some of the things they might have been up against, some of the diseases or.
Well, I can remember a couple of stories that she told about Tanana Crossing. One was about this guy that, these guys were out hunting and this guy got shot and blew his, jaw out. And so when they brought him back in, they, said there's no way he's going to live, he was going to die. And the medicine man, worked on him and stuff. And just were getting him ready to die, and so she went to work and started patching him up and made him live. And so they figured, well, she might be a pretty good medicine woman, because the rest of them would give up on him. She made him pull through. And there's a few little stories like that she used to tell.
Did they talk much about the medicine people, I imagine before they were doctors and nurses, pretty much that was the way people, depended on for cures and things. Did they talk about as a nurse or as a missionary, any kind of run-ins you'd have with the medicine people?
Well, they were probably resented her, doing this nursing type thing, because it's altogether different than their way of tending to their problems, But never had any real serious problems.
Yeah, we hear some stories about people, maybe it's way farther down than you, but missionaries maybe from 50 years before that, and they would really attempt to challenge the medicine men because of, their particular beliefs and things like that. And so there'd be various confrontations going on.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know what it was like in Upper Tanana, what was going on there.
Yeah, well, it was, there was conflict, but nothing that was, real serious. As near as I can figure out. But, after the, of course, she probably never pushed him or anything, maybe if somebody was really out to get a medicine man, he'd be out to get them too, So
yeah, right.
It just depends on the different people, how they operate. And
she's pretty easy going that way.
Though. Yeah. And she'd get along pretty good with everybody.
You mentioned earlier a book that Your father had translated stories?
Oh, yeah.
What was the name of this?
Yabal Taliana. It was just, you know, the stories they tell about him. He's kind of a character like Hiawatha, you know. He has, and they just have all these different stories about Yabal Taliana and how he, you know, accomplished all these different feats. And he just, you know, knew these stories from when he was a kid. You know, he'd hear them, and so he just made notes of them later on and wrote them up in this little church magazine. And then it was the same thing that my mother took later and got all this stuff together, and they made it into a little book called Yabal Taliana. It's just actually, you know, Indian stories of that area.
Yeah,
it just came out about, well, 2 or 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Just a little small book.
And but, the children are the ones who put together, you and your brother?
No.
Who put
them? Well, actually, see, my mother did most of it, and I mean, gathering the stuff up, but we just each chipped in to have the thing published, see.
Mm-hmm.
And this girl, Joan Weiss, that's writing a book about my mother, she helped her, you know, get it together.
So there's a book being written about your mother.
Yeah, yeah. She was working on it, and at the time she died, she was in an automobile accident and never recovered from it, but... she was far enough along with it that this Joan Weiss got most of the information she needed, you know, to do it. So it's probably going to be published in another year or so. You can get probably a lot of information out of it.
All right. So then from Tanacross, or Tanana Crossing, is that the same as Tanacross?
Tanacross, they just changed the name. It used to be called Tanana Crossing. And there was a point in the Tanana River where they crossed, you know, from one side to the other. The reason it had that name.
What's there now?
There's a village there. And see, during the war, they built an airfield there when they were ferrying all these planes over to Russia. They built an emergency strip there. And it's still being used. And see, they've moved the village from where it used to be on the north side of the river, and they've moved it over to the south side now. So there's not much left there on the old village.
Have you gone back there on occasion?
I've been, yeah, flying. I've flown in there a lot since then. But the first time I'd been back was probably in about, since I left there, would maybe about 1948. And then I've been in there, you know, occasionally ever since on trips that I make flying in and out. But I've never lived there anymore.
When you were born, I imagine your mother was the one with most of the medical knowledge right there in the village.
Yeah.
Did she have anybody to help her?
Yeah, there was a nurse came from Nenana up there at the time, just before I was born, and stayed with my dog teams that came up. And I can't even remember what her name was. But I've heard it enough, I should know. But I can't remember.
So were you the firstborn?
No, I was the second one. Yeah, older brother was born in Fairbanks. A year and a half before him. He was a year and a half older than I was.
His name
was Arthur.
So how many brothers and sisters do you have?
I had 6 brothers and no sister. Seven boys in the family.
Seven.
All a bunch of renegades.
So you said that you Well, you were very young when you were in Utah.
Yeah, when we first were there. See, and we only lived there for 3 years, but then back to Nenana, but then I was in and out of there all the time after that.
Do you have any memories from the first 3 years?
Yeah, a few.
What things do you remember from that?
Well, one story I can remember was, that I'll never forget, was my dad took me up fishing in a place called Tawchacket. We fished just with fish nets, you know, in the spring. And so he pulled out a net full of pike and told me not to put my finger in their mouth or I'd get it bit, you know. So the first thing I did was go down the boat when he went up to make camp and stick my finger in his mouth to feel his teeth. So he clamped down on me and I was screaming and hollering, so he had to come down, pry his mouth open and get my finger out of the pike's mouth.
Never touched anybody who actually stuck
their
finger in.
Boy, I did.
I know lots of people are scared of it. Tawchacket, where is that?
That's about 10 miles upstream from Minto. It's a kind of a slough, dead slough that I used to go hunting in all the time, duck hunting, and there's a lot of fish in it, whitefish and pike.
It's on the north side of the river.
It's on the south side of the river. It heads out of Linder Lake, a lake that's quite popular for duck hunting out of Nenana.
Right.
So, do you remember any other stories?
Well, I know when we were there, there was a lot of caribou used to come through in the spring and fall. And, you know, we'd always be hunting caribou. But it seems like after... Oh, they never came through anymore after about, last time I saw any down there was about 1948, I think, coming through that area. In those days, they'd come through by the thousands, you know, in the spring and fall. They'd just, for a week or 10 days straight, there'd be, you know, just a steady stream of caribou going through from one side to the other.
You know what happened with them
going through there? Well, lots of theories. The wolf population got high. They probably had some diseases that cut the population down. And then, of course, it's the same bunch of caribou that crossed the Steese Highway all the time. You know, in later years, they got hunting them so heavy there that, you know, they about annihilated between the wolves and the people. They got to them, but I think it's just, you know, one of the ups and downs. They have game population gets high and then declines to pretty near nothing and then starts over again. But I know when they took the bounties off the wolves, the population really went down. But that was later. That was, you know, a lot later. But I can remember, you know, down there going with my dad out to some of the spring camps when he'd have to have a funeral or one thing or another that the preacher always had to perform. And I remember one trip he went to. There was an old guy named Boatman that lived up there at this Tawchacket, the place I was telling you where we're fishing, and he raised potatoes. So one towards spring, come in. But anyway, he was going along this up to get these potatoes in. It was towards the end of the winter, and we were running short of groceries, and so. It'd take him, you know, a day to go up there and a day to come back. So I decided the day he was coming back, I'd go out and meet him. See, and so I started walking out down this trail, and God, I walked and walked. You know, I must have walked about 5 miles, and I was starting to get, you know, kind of tired and wondering what the hell happened to him, you know. He never showed up, and so I got to dreaming, and I dreamt that I was going across this lake and kind of daydreaming, and I fell in this hole, and down under there was this beautiful land. You know, it had beautiful green summer. It was nice and warm. It wasn't cold anymore. And it was this place I was dreaming about. I didn't know it 40 years later. But anyway, I finally come across them and came home. But I can always remember. That always sticks in my mind.
Well, it did. So you fell through this lake. But I mean, are you thinking about falling through this lake and this warm place? Did people ever talk about a place that wasn't cold?
I can't remember, no.
Just invented the whole thing.
Well, yeah, I didn't know there was no place like that existed, you know. I might have, you know, heard it from my folks somewhere or another, but I don't recall it.
At least most people weren't thinking about falling through
and coming into paradise.
So that was, you know, maybe it's best to talk more about Hawaii instead.
Since we were on it, why don't we get some dates? Like what year you were born in?
Well, I was born in 1925.
Yeah.
So the time in winter was.
Well, see, I was when we moved there, I was 5 years old, so it must have been about 1930, and around then till about 33 or 34 when we moved out of there. But I was just, you know, old enough to start hunting and stuff before we left. My dad bought me a little .22 single shot. I'd go out hunting ducks and muskrats and stuff in the ponds, you know, close around. And they were always chasing me down because I figured I was out and get something wrong with me, I'd get lost or something. But I always liked to hunt. And
do you remember any sort of training you had for that?
Oh yeah, my dad always took us out, you know. Showed us how to get by, you know. We'd go out and live in the you know, camp in the winter time when it was cold, so we knew how to keep alive when it was cold and hunt and everything. But he'd take us kids hunting all the time with him and fishing, you know, and stuff. So we knew how to do things from when we were pretty small.
So he'd take you out camping.
Yeah.
Tent or?
Well, we never used no tent. No, we just sidewashed it all the time. Mm-hmm. Just under some spruce boughs or something.
Well, he was, along with being a missionary then, he was sort of taking care of his own subsistence too?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they allowed him so much, but it was such a small amount that he couldn't make a living on it. So they always grew a big garden in the summer. Of course, he got all his fish and we always had a fish wheel in the river, and then we set, you know, nets in the spring and when there's no salmon coming. So they probably half lived off the country and half off of what they got from their churches, and, you know, for living.
Well, what was, I can't stop thinking about that place. I have to shift gears and get over here pretty soon. But Minto, you know, Minto, of course, you know, it's gone through some incredible changes since 71. But what was it like then? What was
Well, it was, you know, it was right there on the Tanana River, and every spring they got flooded out. Britain here, those Some years they didn't, but not too much. It didn't make much, huh?
They have big boardwalk built right then.
That was, didn't build that till way later. In, oh, that was in the 60s they built that. At the time, early time, there was just, you know, paths and all one-room cabins. Except the only, when my dad moved down there, they built this mission house. And it was a two-story log house. And of course, everybody was built close to the river. And most all of the original village at that time is in the river. It all caved in, you know, now. And people moved back further away from it. So where the village sits now, the old village is all relatively new. Because it all had to be moved, you know, most of it. There was a few cabins where it is now, but they were, you know, way back from the main part of the village. And let's see, most of the people didn't, you know, they didn't live in the village. They'd go out in their dead trapping cabins out wherever their trap line was, and they'd be out there most of the time. And it was hard for, I know my dad tried to start a school there, and he'd have a real hard time because, you know, there wasn't enough kids around. They'd be there for a little while and then they'd be all gone. So maybe he'd run the school for a month or so, and then they'd, most of them would take off, you know, they'd close it down. He had a little one-room cabin close to the where we lived there that he had school. Each kid would have to bring a stick of wood to school in the morning for tuition, keep the fire going.
And they have school until the stove went out, huh?
Yeah. They had enough wood to last through the day, they keep going.
So what other kinds of things would they do with the mission? What kind of center was the mission?
Well, mainly it was, you know, he had a church there. They had services on Sunday, and they did this, oh, you know, like these. My mother was, you know, took care of all the nursing problems of the village, and then they, you know, the church people would send clothes and all that kind of stuff up that he'd distribute out to the people that needed it, and it's just a regular, I guess, whatever missionaries do, We lived there, you know, the year round, but in the spring, there was nobody left in the village at all. They all went out into the rat camp. They'd go before breakup, and then they wouldn't come back until after the ice was gone, you know, and they'd come back in by boat or, they'd go back into the lakes. They'd go by dog team. It was about 15 miles back there where most of them lived. And then to come out, they came down the river, which is about 60 miles to get back to the village.
Which river exactly?
They'd come down the Chattanooga River and into the Tolovana, and then down the Tolovana into the Tanana, and then up the Tanana to Minto. And then, of course, they'd all be in the village there for a while, and then as soon as the salmon started running, they'd all move to their fish camp. You know, each family would have, or a couple families would have a camp along the river where they kept their wheel, fish wheel, and they'd put up fish and till fall, and then they'd all move back again to the village in the fall. So, you know, they never started, most of them didn't move permanent there till, till they had a school and a regular school, and the government said that kids all had to go to school, and so then they had to live permanent there, and then most of them, you know, stayed permanent and just go to their trap line. Their wives stay home after that, and a few of them didn't, but most of them.
That was sometime in the 40s.
That was in the 40s sometime when they first, I can't remember the exact date they started that school down there, but the BIA put it in.
Yeah, I think it was So when people are going out to camp, would your father spend a lot of time traveling out to camp?
Yeah, he'd go out, you know, make a few trips out there in the camps in the before breakup. But otherwise, then he'd just have to, you know, stay there and take care of the place. Mm-hmm. And
do you ever go with him on
them? Yeah, I'd go once in a while.
What kinds of things do you remember seeing? Things that he would do when he went out?
Well, the only thing I can remember is he'd have, you know, he'd be going to have some kind of church services or something, or they'd have a funeral out there or something. He'd go out and bury somebody, have the services and that kind of stuff. Or if somebody was getting married, he'd go out there and marry him, that kind of stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. But,
must have been, you know, interesting for him being, not being an outsider, and knowing some of the old ways of people. You know, I know missionaries have different ways of dealing with the fact that people do some of the old ways and also Christian ways. Do you know, remember him ever talking about things or things you noticed, how he would combine the two?
Oh, yeah, he would, because, you know, he could, you know, talk their language as good as they could, and he did a lot of translating and stuff for them. And in the early days, there was, you know, most of the older people could talk some English, but not very good. And so he could communicate with them real good because he could talk, you know, their language. And
what about things like rites, like for burial rites, and what kind of things might have gone on then that don't now?
Well, at that time, I think it was just about the same as it is now, but it was just probably getting started in, you know, the white man way of doing things. Then I don't know really what they did before that, except I know they used to, you know, instead of using coffins, they wrapped people in birch bark when they buried them. And I remember one time we went and dug up some old graves, or he did. I was along with him. He had some archaeologist or somebody came along and wanted to dig up some old bones of people. And so he showed them where these old graves were, so they dug them up. And that's the way they were all put in there, was wrapped up in birch bark.
But they weren't doing that.
No, by that time they were doing it just like the white people, and using coffins and stuff like that, same kind of services and stuff.
So let's see, from 1935 to 1965. When was it you came to Hawaii?
Well, we didn't come. We came over here the first time. Yeah. About 10 years ago. Let's see, what would that be? This is 80? But, yeah.
What made you choose to come to Hawaii? How did that get started?
Well, see, my wife, Jeannie, ran a travel service up there in Fairbanks, along with the air service. And so we get these free trips around, you know, once a year or twice a year. We started traveling all over the world to see what was going on, and we came here a couple of times, and then later on we decided, well, maybe we should be finding a warm place to kind of get out of the cold later on. So we started looking all over the world for a place to go, and You know, most places you go, there's a foreign government, and you don't know what's going to happen. And here it's an American-owned place, and the same customs as you're used to. And then we decided, well, you know, this Hawaiian Islands is probably the best place because of that, and plus the fact it has the best climate of any place. So then we started going from one island to the other, trying to, you know, find the best island to live on. And we liked it here because at that time there was, you know, it was just like a little small community. There was no traffic, hardly any cars here at that time. And they got good hunting and fishing around here. And it just fit in with our way of life. So we figured, well, this is the place to go, you know. So we started looking for some land around here and bought this lot. And about 7 years ago, we built this house. And, but, you know, we always like to hunt and everything. And you can go up here on the hill and get sheep and goats and pigs, turkeys, all kinds of things, you know, to hunt. And, of course, you can pretty good fishing down here most of the time. Some of the time. So
it's possible anyway.
Yeah. So anyway, we liked it here better than any place else, so we just decided to come here. And then as we could afford it, we'd come over here and spend a vacation. And then until we built this place, and then we've been coming every winter since then for, you know, whatever time we can get away, from 2 to 4 or 5 months. And I don't think we'll ever, you know, really live here permanent, because we like it in Alaska too in the summer. But since there's not much doing in the winter, and we don't have to be there, well, we figure it's better to winter here.
Mm-hmm. What kind of, how would hunting be different here than it is in Alaska?
Well, it isn't much different. Mm-hmm. It's just different things that you hunt. Like, you hunt the same way as you do there, practically.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we go 2 or 3 times a year up on the hill and get a sheep or a couple of pigs. Or we always get a turkey or two for Christmas dinner. And there's pheasants and, you know, chuckers, all kinds of game birds around here too. That are good.
You ever use dogs when you have two
kids? Yeah. We have a friend up here that's got some dogs, and if you want to hunt easy, you take the dogs, you know, because they do the hunting. But if you go without them, it's a lot harder to get pigs than if you use a dog.
If you don't take dogs, do you end up pig trails a lot?
Yeah, you just have to hunt.
Tangles.
Yeah, you have to just, and you have to stay in more open country where you can see better. You can't get in any of that thick stuff because you'll never see the pig. You'll hear them running, but you never see them. But if you have a dog, see, then they can corner them and hold them till you get there. But see, in Alaska, though, it's, for any kind of hunting, it's illegal to use dogs. So you have to, you know, it's a little different hunting, all right, but around here, places are close together, you know, you don't have to go very far. Mm-hmm. Where up there, you have to go a long ways to get different things.
Well, fishing is a different thing,
isn't it?
Yeah. You would explain to young people there how you know about fishing, how would you tell them?
Fishing here, you mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's different than up there because it's all, you know, saltwater fishing. And most of it is trolling. Well, there's different ways you can, you know, throw some lures over the back of the boat and troll for marlin or mahi-mahi or ahi or, you know, just about any kind of fish, ono. But then, you can bottom fish too, but it's so deep Like if you're bottom fishing, you have to have a line that's about between 1,000 and 2,000 feet long to reach the bottom. And it takes a long time to get it down and get it back up again. A lot of work. Unless you have a electric reel, which we don't have. But
how long do you crank on those reels to get it down there?
Most of the time you use a hand line, just pull it, you throw it over and let it over. You have a hand line that you put in a big basket, and then you put your bait on it, and a weight. Generally you use a rock, and then with a, you tie it up so it's got a slip knot, so when it gets down as deep as you want to go, you jerk it, and it unties the knot, and the rock falls off, and then your bait's just floating. And you hope something grabs it. But if you catch something way down to the bottom, it might take you 15, 20 minutes or half an hour to pull it up, pull the line back up. And if you got something on, it'd probably take you longer.
What's your favorite kind of fish here?
I like the, for eating, the Ono.